Good afternoon. It's 3 o'clock and you are tuned to KTUO News in Juneau here on Monday, the 4th of June, the year 2012. Jeff Brown with you here on a Juneau afternoon. Today we'll talk to filmmaker Glenn McElhenney about her film On These Shoulders We Stand, showing tonight at the Colton Nickelodeon Theater. We'll be talking to Ken Fix about the Venus Transit of the Sun scene tomorrow. We'll meet at Marine Park at about 2 o'clock. Find out about it today here on KTUO's Juneau afternoon. The forecast for tonight, partly cloudy skies with low temperatures around 46 degrees. Forecast for Tuesday, mostly cloudy skies with a chance of showers in the afternoon. And Tuesday night, looks like rain showers are likely with low temperatures around 46 degrees.
This is Bird Note. Stretching across a good portion of southern New Jersey lies a region known as the Pine Barrens, with broad tracts of pine forest interspersed with grassland and shrubland. The Pine Barrens remain one of the largest expanses of green in the Northeast. So, why do we call so green a region a barrens? Early European settlers tried farming here, but the sandy, acidic soil wasn't suited to their traditional crops. Because the land proved unproductive for them, they called it barren. The name stuck. Despite their gloomy name, the New Jersey Pine Barrens support a diversity of plants and animals. Bright yellow prairie warblers trill atop young pines. Great crested flycatchers call out overhead. Upland sandpipers, a scarce and threatened species, nest in open grasslands. For the Pine Barrens and its native habitats, agricultural barrenness has proven a saving grace. If its soils grew traditional crops, it would have, centuries ago, disappeared beneath the plow. Today's show brought to you by the Bobolink Foundation. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Tribal and federal officials and other leaders break ground on the historic Navajo Gallup Water Supply Project. As KGLP's Rachel Cobb reports, a ceremony was held over the weekend in New Mexico.
Following water rights litigation and studies that began four decades ago, Saturday's groundbreaking marked the beginning of construction on the first 4 miles of the main pipeline outside of Gallup, New Mexico. The initial stage of construction on the project will create upwards of 450 jobs, with more than 650 jobs at peak construction. President Shelley.
Water is sacred to our people, and we need to do everything we can to make water available to every Navajo home.
Today is a proud and historic day for President Barack Obama as he honors his commitment to the Indian nations of the United States of America because they are the first Americans.
Secretary Salazar referred to the Obama administration's commitment to expedite high-priority infrastructure projects for the nation. Ultimately, the project will provide 280 miles of pipeline, 2 water treatment plants, and a delivery system that will serve 43 Navajo chapters, the southwest portion of the Jicarilla Apache Nation, and the city of Gallup. Secretary Salazar.
This is really about the young people. It's the young people of the Navajo Nation, of the Jicarilla Apache Nation, of the people of Gallup, of the people of New Mexico.
The pipeline project, which will provide a long-term sustainable water supply to a population expected to reach approximately 250,000 people by the year 2040, will start providing water to some communities within 2 to 3 years and is expected to be fully built out by 2024. For National Native News, this is Rachel Cobb.
A Native American community development financial institution has announced that 30 houses are being prepared for purchase on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota. As Jim Kent reports, the sale of individual housing units will be the largest ever flood of homes on deeded land into the reservation's real estate market.
The Eagle Nest Housing Development is located just outside the village of Wambli on the Pine Ridge Reservation. Completed in 1999 to provide rental housing for qualified tribal members, the homes are scheduled for sale in 2014. Lakota Funds, the Pine Ridge Reservation-based CDFI that coordinated the original construction of the Eagle Nest Housing Development, is also handling the sale of the homes. Lakota Funds Executive Director Tony Brunch says the tenants living in the homes right now have the first opportunity to buy them.
Because Lakota Funds offers the Match Savings Program, which is our individual development accounts, we are making those available, and we have had tenants open those already for the purpose of tripling their money, and will allow them to save up to $5,400 that can be used for the down payment on this home.
Burns says with available housing at a crisis level on the Pine Ridge Reservation, offering the opportunity for 30 families to own their own homes is a major step in the right direction. For National Native News, I'm Jim Kent.
Over the weekend, the Oglala Sioux Tribe and the National Park Service signed a record of decision on a management plan for the south unit of Badlands National Park. The plan would establish the nation's first tribal national park. The south unit of Badlands National Park is entirely within the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota. According to the National Park Service, the Park Service and the tribe have worked together to manage the south unit's more than 100,000 acres for nearly 40 years. Legislation needs to be developed and approved by Congress to establish the park. The Oglala Sioux Tribe would then manage it. Sea Alaska Heritage Institute is kicking off its biennial Native Dance and Culture Celebration this week in Juneau. It's the 30th year since the inception of the festival, which is expected to draw thousands of people. The festival includes dance performances, arts, film screenings, and workshops. On this day in 1960, Stockbridge Munsee and Menominee actress and producer Sheila Mae Towsey was born. One of her first performances on stage was at the University of New Mexico. She has since appeared in movies including Thunderheart, Two Gray Hills, and Coyote Waits. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation. Funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Nathan Cummings Foundation.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Service.
Time is 3:08 and you are tuned to KTUO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. First guests are here to talk about the film that's going to be shown tonight at the Golden Nickelodeon Theater, On These Shoulders We Stand. It's an honor of great gay pride, and in the studio with us are Lynn Davis, Marsha Buck, and filmmaker Glenn McElhenney. Thank you for coming down to the station, everybody.
Great to be here. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thanks.
So let's start off this with a brief conversation about the gay rights movement in Alaska and how it relates to the gay rights movement here in Juneau. Lynn, you want to start us off?
Hi, this is Lynn. I've been here about 20 years, and the first big event for me was in 1998 when the whole state voted on Proposition 2, which was to write us gay people out of the Constitution by saying that marriage is only for a man and a woman. And I believe we were the first state in the country to pass this kind of discriminatory legislation. And the vote we lost, and it was a very divisive time for our state and for those of us who were gay. It was a very difficult time. Things were said about us that no mother holding her newborn would ever want said about her child. The year after that, 12 of us lesbian and gay couples sued the state of Alaska for domestic partner benefits. ACLU handled that case. And about 8 years later, we got our benefits. It was a long haul chipping away to get our rights. And I was able to retire from the state last year and have my domestic partner benefits for my partner of 24 years. So I really appreciate the progress that our state has made.
Mm-hmm. I could fill in a little history. In addition to that, here in Juneau, there's a group called the Southeast Alaska Gay and Lesbian Alliance, and that was formed in 1985. So it's been here and active since 1985. And then PEPLAG Juneau, which I'm a part of, was formed in 1995. So there have been some ongoing history here in Juneau of organizations. Same is true in Anchorage, although I don't know that history as well. But I think the group called Identity, has been around in Anchorage since, back in the late 80s, hasn't it, Lynn? Do you know?
That sounds right, yeah.
And I'm sure Glenn will hear more about those Anchorage groups when she gets to Anchorage. But there is a history here in Juneau. And then, of course, the Juneau Pride Course that started in 1997 that's carried on the history in Juneau as well.
And PFLAG is an acronym for?
Oh, thank you for asking. I would like to say it every time I say PFLAG. PFLAG stands for Parents, Families, and Friends of Lesbians and Gays. And we are an education, support, and advocacy group for family members, friends and family members of gays, lesbians, bisexuals, and transgendered folks, and even intersex folks. Now, that's been added in recent years, and I'm delighted.
The film we're talking about in a few minutes here is called On These Shoulders We Stand. It's a film in honor of Gay Pride Week or month?
The whole month of June is Gay Pride Month.
And the filmmaker is Glenn McElhinney. Glenn, thank you for coming into the station today.
Yeah, it's great to be in Juneau. I just flew up from Los Angeles last night.
You've been in Juneau West before, but briefly to see the glacier.
Briefly, yeah, on a quick cruise. Wanted to come back. Great to be back.
Tell me about your background, please.
I'm actually an auto mechanic. I was in the automotive industry for over 30 years, wrenching on cars and motorcycles mostly. And I saw a movie called Paragraph 175. And for those folks who aren't familiar with that film, it's a film about the gay men and women who wore the pink triangles in the concentration camps in World War II. They wore the pink triangles on their tunics, and I saw that film and it changed my life. And I decided to quit my job and my career and become an oral historian.
How long ago was that?
And that was 2007, the very end of 2007. And so I founded my own oral history project called Impact Stories. And that's what brought me to set up a camera in senior centers around the state and film LGBT elders giving their stories. And the whole project will be going to the state of California. And the film is the very first production of Impact Stories. And the film, again, is called On These Shoulders We Stand. And I set up a camera in a senior center and recorded LGBT elders talking about what gay life was like in Los Angeles growing up.
How many senior centers did you visit?
I've been to a bunch all over the place, all over California, literally from Sacramento to San Diego. So many, many. There's senior programs, senior centers, senior bingo, senior events at restaurants, and all kinds of different things where LGBT seniors congregate and know how to find each other. And I go there and present about the history project and that I want to gather their stories.
And these people, I'm assuming, are of an age that it would be difficult for them to come out and talk about openly.
Very much so. Some of them are still traumatized by what they went through, in terms of bullying, of course, and what it was like to be called queer later on, you know, early on in their lives. They have a lot of scars still because they're older, 60s, 70s, 80s. The oldest one in the film is in beginning their early 90s.
How do you break through the barrier?
Trust. Continuing to be insistent that their stories mattered. I got a lot of resistance from some of the seniors early on saying that they thought that no one would care and that young people didn't care and that it wouldn't matter. And I just kept coming back and back and meeting with people and presenting at these functions saying that their stories do matter. And I built up trust with people. And then the history project started to get momentum in terms of, you know, that people would trust it and know that I was a legitimate oral historian that really cared about their stories.
You must have collected dozens of hours of video.
Only a few so far, but yes, there are several dozen, and I'm about to embark on a new project, too, which we can talk about later, maybe. But right now, the film has been the main thing, and then touring with the film. And my whole focus, of which the elders were, too, was that we wanted young people to see the film. And so my focus has been trying to get the film into middle schools and high schools to see it.
What was the process of editing it like?
Of editing it? That was hard. Because it was revisiting the stories, and almost all of them, almost every single one cried during the interview. It didn't make it to the film because, you know, you don't really want people crying in a film, but it was hard, and hearing the stories And editing itself is also just a really long, tedious, important process of making the film and narrowing it down to the final moments that make it in.
How did it change you?
I can tell you one great story is I'm a native San Francisco Bay Area, and I'm from Oakland, and I had never heard these stories, knew nothing of them. And we have a different view and take on life, I think, growing up gay in the San Francisco Bay Area. We're much more part of fabric and part of the life up there and much more accepted. And in Los Angeles, it's really different. Even though it's only 400 miles apart, it's a really different town. And folks in the older days were treated very, very differently. Extremely, almost an opposite polar of how people are treated in San Francisco area. And so that was a real eye-opener of why so many people are closeted and so many people are damaged by how they grew up in Los Angeles and how different it was. So it was a really big learning curve for me, being a native Californian.
Would you like to share a little bit of one or two of the stories?
The one who seems to be the biggest crowd favorite is Nancy Valverde, who grew up in Lincoln Heights area, which is just east of downtown L.A., and she was constantly harassed as a butch lesbian for wearing male-gendered clothing, what's considered male-gendered clothing. And what they would do, the police would arrest her because of her clothing, because there was a masquerading ordinance on the books, an impersonation law, where if you didn't dress to gender code, you could get arrested. And they would drive by slowly and look at where her zippers were on her pants, and if the zipper was on the front, she would get arrested. If the zipper was on the side of the back, they would let her go, and they would check the side that the buttons were on her shirt, and if they were on the male side, they would arrest her. If the buttons were on the female side, they'd let her go. And she spent time in jail over and over again, and they would, just to be mean, they would arrest her on Friday night and keep her in jail over the weekend and not tell her family and not book her. And this was constant. The LAPD is just, the stories are horrific about our treatment of LGBT folks from Los Angeles.
Wasn't Nancy interviewed at the end of the L Word on the special features at the end of the L Word?
I think it is. It is the same famous Nancy Valverde.
Right. Well, I recognize the name.
You have a good memory, too. Yes, it is. She is. It's such an incredible story. The law was enacted in Los Angeles in 1897. And used horrifically against us.
I imagine there's a lot of crying in front of the lens and also behind the lens.
Pardon?
A lot of crying in front of the lens and behind the lens.
Yeah, both Gina DeGirolamo, who's the cinematographer, and I, both days of filming, both just talked later of what an emotional day it was for us to sit and hear the stories and see these people. And Troy Perry talked about listening to beatings in the county jail in Los Angeles. He got arrested twice in the early 70s for hunger strikes because they wouldn't change the laws about the consenting adults bill and other things where they just would not enact. He wanted to enact gay marriage. He was a very early gay marriage activist, and he's a pastor, a reverend with MCC Church, and he would perform marriages, and then they would try to break up the marriage and, you know, come in and try to break up the ceremony. And so he did a hunger strike and he went to jail, and it didn't make it into the film because it's just too emotional, but listening to a beating of a young man who had been brought into the jail. And he ended up going to the, after hearing this beating, the guy went out on a gurney. I mean, that's how bad it was.
I'm talking to Glenn McElhinney, filmmaker of the film On These Shoulders We Stand. It's showing tonight at the Golden Nickelodeon. What time does the film show start?
7 p.m.
And it's free.
And there's a group discussion following?
Yep. Afterwards, we're going to do a film Q&A, and locals are going to come and talk about their experiences, too. And I'll talk about making of the film and where all the elders are today.
Can people get copies of the film?
It's not ready for distribution yet. We're trying to get it up on PBS, and PBS is very interested in the film. So I'm fundraising to finish it and bump it up to broadcast quality so we can get it up on PBS and get the film out there.
Glenn, you talked about future projects.
I've got a new one that's just getting funding. It's just kicking off actually this summer, and it's funded through the California Council on the Humanities and the National Endowment for the Humanities. And it's my new project called Tales of California: Briggs, Bryant, Homophobia, and the Coming Pandemic. And I'm specializing in the 70s, the late 60s and early 70s, and that beautiful arc that the gay community had in California of gaining rights and then how that very first year of AIDS, it all came crashing to a halt.
Do you think this film could have been made 20, 30 years ago?
I think it could have been, but I'm not so sure it would have gotten as great a response because people were more closeted and not as supportive of the gay rights movement as they are now.
Do you have a website?
I do. It's impactstories.org.
Tell me more about Impact Stories, if you could, please.
Impact Stories is the oral history project that I started, and it's all about gathering and documenting our culture, our history, the vibrancy of the gay life, and what it's like in California. And it's a statewide history project. We go from Crescent City to El Centro.
I'm talking to Lynn Davis, Marsha Buck, and also Glenn McElhinney, involved in the project On These Shoulders We Stand. Again, that starts at 6 tonight?
7 o'clock.
7 o'clock tonight at the Golden Nickelodeon. There'll be a panel discussion following. Is there anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
I would just add that this event is sponsored by the Pride Foundation, PFLAG, SIGLA, which is Southeast Alaska Lesbian Gay Alliance, and
One Anchorage.
One Anchorage.
It was the campaign recently to end discrimination in Anchorage. So they helped fund it.
You're going to travel around also?
Yeah, we're going to be screening in Anchorage three times. We're at the Senior Center, we're at the University of Anchorage, University of Alaska Anchorage, and also at Out North Coffee House. I think it's called Out North Coffee House.
What do people do at the end of the film? Are they a lot of them crying, or a lot of them empowered?
People, we do surveys, especially with students. Every student who sees the film gets a survey, both pre and post, after seeing the film, and they talk about how inspiring it is. To see a film where it shows how people bumped up against really overt discrimination and how they started to gather and understand that they were being discriminated against and then what they did to fight back and stand up. And they knew that they were standing up not only for themselves, but they knew that they were standing up for people that were coming behind them and how important that was for them to know that there were going to be people behind them. So they really did help create change in Los Angeles in a big way.
Glenn, is this used in the curriculum in California?
Yeah, we're using it. It's starting to be used under the Fair Education Act in California, and it is getting a lot of traction with both middle school and high school teachers and principals across the state. And I've been touring with the film now for 6 months, funded by the Yahoo Employee Foundation. They're out of Sunnyvale, California, and they saw the film and came to me and said, we really want to help this film get out into the world. So they've funded, I have 6 more months of touring with the film, and they underwrite costs to get it, especially to rural areas of California. That's where we are concentrating on. Normally, that wouldn't get to see a film and a filmmaker normally show up in these small towns in California.
What surprised you most about the reaction you've received?
The kind of other reactions
What surprised you as far as the other reactions?
I've been really surprised at the positive. You know, I thought I might bump into more people that wanted to fight or didn't like the film or, you know, put it down or put down us. And even people that are straight and not our allies see the film and say that it really opens up an area that they really hadn't thought about, that it really opens up their eyes. And so, you know, I just wanted to put seniors on film and document our history. I had no idea that doing this would really help create that kind of change, especially with heterosexuals who say they had no idea that homosexuals early on face this kind of really bad discrimination and that it does change lives. Young people, they just don't know the history at all, but they don't feel that discrimination. But especially we get a lot of reports from older heterosexual people who said they had no idea that our community was going through what we were at that time.
Well, Marsha and Lynn, thank you very much for coming down to the station again. Is there anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
I would just add one quotation from Maya Angelou. She says, we live in relationship to our heroes, and we learn courage and wisdom from them. And I think that's what Glenn is bringing to us with her work.
Again, the film starts at 7 o'clock at the Golden Nickelodeon Theater. It'll be followed by a panel discussion On These Shoulders We Stand. Glenn, the website one more time, please.
Is impactstories.org. And thank you for inviting us.
Everybody needs someone to show them what is possible. Everybody needs someone to go as far as she can see. I need to stand upon the shoulders of giants. I need a woman who's as big as me. When I was a little bitty baby sitting on my mama's knee, I looked around to see just what the future had in store for me. I needed to see women who were living without limits. I needed to see women making history. So I said, give me a woman who can climb the tallest mountain. Give me a woman who can swim across the widest sea. Women need women who lead lives of boldest daring. Tell me their stories, they inspire me. Give me Amelia, who went soaring across the ocean. Winnie Mandela, who is gonna set her people free. Judy Chicago, who breaks all artistic silences. These women leave a precious legacy. When I was a young teenager, reading my 17, I looked around to see just what the future had in store for me. Women in the fashion mags were too small for my dream. I needed to see women just as big as me. So I said, give me a woman who can climb the tallest mountain. Give me a woman who can swim across the widest sea. Women need women who lead lives of boldest daring. Tell me their stories, they inspire me. I know of women all across the nation, leading lives of courage in the face of fear and poverty. One lives in an abusive home, one raises her five children. Women we need in new mythology. Now that I'm a grown-up woman living in society, I still look around to see just what the future holds for me. I still need women who are shooting like a comet, so I can leave my own starlight in this galaxy. I say, give me a woman who can climb the tallest mountain. Give me a woman who can swim across the widest sea. Women need women who lead lives of boldest daring. Tell me their stories, they inspire me. Won't you sing? Tell me their stories, they inspire me. I'd like to tell you their stories, they inspire me. Won't you sing? Tell me their stories, they inspire me. Won't you please tell me your story, you inspire me. I'd like to tell you their stories, they inspire me. Won't you please tell me the stories, they inspire me. I'd like to hear your story, you inspire me. Won't you please tell me their stories, they inspire me.
Libby Roderick, the time is 3:27, and you are tuned to KTUO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. Thanks, get out your binoculars, because we're going to learn how to see the Venus transit of the sun with Ken Fix. Ken, thank you very much for coming down to the station today.
Thanks for having me again, Jeff.
So you were here just last week. How'd the planetarium presentation go?
Oh, it went fairly well. It was kind of a pickup presentations. I covered the god Eros, and I also covered asteroids, including our NASA science mission to Eros, where we actually landed on an asteroid. And then the last topic that I covered was the upcoming Venus transit, and I sort of explained what transits are.
And tomorrow at about 2 o'clock, you're going to be going to Marine Park and take the planetarium outside.
Yes. Virtually all of our volunteers will be down there just before 2 p.m. For the transit of Venus, which will actually take place about 2:04 will be the first contact, and it will be done just before 9 o'clock.
So tell me what the transit is, please.
Well, a transit is sort of like an eclipse, but it's kind of like the two inner planets, Mercury and Venus, are all on like wobbly plates or merry-go-round horses versus the Earth's orbit. And a transit occurs whenever one of those bodies laps us on its racetrack pattern around the sun, but it also has to fall into the same plane of our orbit, which is a zero line between us and the sun, and they have to be on the exact same side of the sun as we are. So the transits occur fairly predictably, but the Mercury transits take place about 13 years apart because Mercury orbits a lot faster than Venus does, 88 days. And Venus transits are very rare. They occur in cycles of about 105 to 113 years, and they occur in pairs. The last one occurred June of 2004, June 8th, and this one's going to occur tomorrow. And we won't see another one again until 2117. So anybody that's listening to this radio program, if you miss this one, you probably will not be around to see the next one.
And I saw a picture on USA Today that had a small little dot in front of the sun. How large is that going to be compared to a planet like Venus going in front of the sun?
If you measured the sun as about the size of a beach ball, Venus will be about the size of a nickel going across it. Whereas if you were looking at Mercury, it'd be about the size of a pea. So Venus will definitely be viewable even without the aid of any binoculars or a telescope. You'll definitely be able to see it going across the sun.
If you want to look at this, there's right ways to do it and definitely wrong ways to do it.
Well, there's a lot of wrong ways to do it. First off, if you've got a solar-safe viewer, which we're going to have down there at Marine Park tomorrow, you'll be able to use that to view the transit safely. That's it's basically photographic negative film with a silver iodide coating on it, so it's safe for solar viewing. If you also have number 14 welder's goggles, you could wear those. But otherwise, there really isn't another safe way to view it except online, which you could go to. I've got the website address for NASA. It's www.venustransit.nasa.gov. And they will be carrying a few different feeds, but the primary one's going to be from the Mauna Kea Observatory in Hawaii.
And there's also a way you could look at it using binoculars.
You can look at it by making a pinhole projection device and projecting it on a piece of paper. That's a real simple way of doing that. So the sun's image would be projected on a piece of paper, and you could safely watch that go across.
Can you also just point the binoculars at the sun and then project the image from the binoculars onto a cardboard piece or a plastic?
That's going to be a little tough to do. I wouldn't recommend that one. It's probably not a good way to do it. But yes, a projection method will work. That's another safe way to view the transit.
And what time are you going to be in Marine Park tomorrow?
We will probably be down there a little bit before 2 o'clock when the transit is expected to start. We'll also have a 10-inch reflector telescope down there with the solar filter on it, safe for viewing, and we'll have the little cardboard solar viewers that are safe for viewing as well, but they don't do any magnification for people to look through. Again, just looking at the sun, you should be able to make out Venus going across the face of the sun.
It's all happening tomorrow down at Marine Park or a solar system near you.
Yes, and the reason that these transits were important is scientists were trying to establish the value of the astronomical unit, which is the average measure between the Earth and the Sun. That's 1 AU, or astronomical unit. We know it is about 93 million miles, give or take about 2 to 4 as we go around the Sun. Our orbit does change a little bit, and ironically, we're actually closer to the Sun in the winter than we are in the summer. It's just our axial tilt that makes the seasons hotter or colder. So working out that astronomical unit was very important, and back in the last set of transits in 1874 and 1882, they were trying to set up observers at different points across the globe in order to time the very points where they saw Venus first make contact with the sun's disk, and then when it went fully inside the sun's disk but was still touching the edge. And by working out those times and the mathematical distances on the points of the Earth, they were able to determine the exact distance between Venus and Earth and able to work out from there the distance from the Earth to the sun. So it was very important, because otherwise you could look up to the sun and say, well, how far is that? Well, 10 million miles, 200 million miles? You know, nobody had a yardstick to measure it for certain, but the mathematics were actually worked out by Edwin Halley. Halley's Comet's named after him. But he didn't live long enough to see the pair of transits that were coming up, but he left detailed instructions for observers in the future in order to establish those points on the Earth and do those exact measurements and timing so they could figure out the astronomical unit.
Ken Fix, thank you for talking about the Venus transit of the Sun tomorrow at Marine Park. It'll, of course, happening at the solar system near you, but the best place to view it is down at Marine Park. They have all the correct tools to use it.
Correct. Yeah, we'll be down there at Marine Park a little bit before 2 in the afternoon, and weather permitting, we'll be likely staying until the end of the transit, which would be just before 9 p.m. our time.
Do you bring any costumes or anything like that to wear?
I'm not bringing anything like that. There's there's nothing that I know that actually matches the transit, but this is a really cool event. This is one of the only times that the planetarium volunteers get out and do things in public, so it's kind of nice to be getting out of the building and get down into, you know, the rest of where all the people are down at Marine Park.
And when is the next presentation at the planetarium itself?
Well, I'm actually starting the summer schedule, which is retro sci-fi movies, and that'll be Tuesday the 26th. The first movie is Robinson Crusoe on Mars. Again, real relaxed atmosphere. People can bring lawn chairs, blankets, bring your own food and drinks. If you're careful about it, we don't mind. And watch a movie in the planetarium. We project it on the Stardome and run the audio through the big sound system there, and it's pretty neat to do. We did it last summer, and I'm glad that we're starting them up again for this summer.
And the date and time for that?
That'll be the 26th of July, which is June, which is a Tuesday night, and it'll start at 6:30.
Okay, thanks. Thank you for going by. Anything like that?
No, that's it. Everybody observe the transit either online or come on down, because you won't see this again probably in your lifetime.
Tonight on 360 North at 7 p.m. get national and international news from the BBC World News and statewide weather on Alaska Weather at 7:30. Then Science for Alaska presents Protecting Our Identity, New Methods for Information Security. Eye-tracking technologies that have been around for 40 years are now becoming affordable and powerful enough to come to a computer near you. That's at 8. And at 9, three unique programs that look at the future of healthcare. Tonight on 360 North.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday. It's the 4th of June, 2012. It's the 40th birthday of the novelist Joe Hill, born Joseph Hillstrom King in Herman, Maine, 1972, author of two novels, Heart-Shaped Box and Horns, and a collection of short stories, 20th Century Ghosts. Joe Hill, who used a pen name because he wanted to see if he could make it as a writer, on his own merit and not as the son of the novelist Stephen King. It was on this date in 1896, a young engineer, Henry Ford, completed the building and successfully tested his first experimental automobile, which he called the quadricycle. It was on four bicycle tires. He'd been working on it for 2 years out in the shed behind his house on Bagley Avenue in Detroit. It was all ready to test when he discovered it was too wide to go through the door of the workshop, so he had to take an axe to the door frame and the bricks and open up the garage, and soon he was rolling down Grand River Avenue. Two-cycle, four-horsepower engine. It could go up to 20 miles per hour. It had two gears and no brakes, ran on ethanol. It was steered by a tiller. Was not much to look at, but the test drive was a success. It was on this date, 1913, the British suffragist Emily Wilding Davison threw herself in front of George V's racehorse at the Epsom Derby, one of the most famous horse races in the world. She crawled under the rail and stepped in front of the horse. She was intending to stick a suffragette flag to the saddle, but the horse ran straight into her. She was knocked into the air, never regained consciousness, died of her injuries 4 days later. And it was on this date, 1919, the 19th Amendment passed the Senate and gave American women the right to vote, an amendment drafted by Susan B. Anthony with the help of Elizabeth Cady Stanton. It was first formally introduced in 1878. It didn't come up before the Senate in 1887. It was voted down, wasn't considered again until 1914, defeated again. But in 1918, President Wilson threw his support behind the suffrage movement. During the war, women had entered the workforce in large numbers. Wilson said, "We have made partners of the women in this war. Shall we admit them only to a partnership of suffering and sacrifice and not to a partnership of right?" And the amendment passed both houses of Congress the following spring. Here's a poem for today by E.E. Cummings. It may not always be so. It may not always be so. And I say that if your lips, which I have loved, should touch another's, and your dear strong fingers clutch his heart as mine in time not far away, if on another's face your sweet hair lay in such a silence as I know, or such great writhing words as uttering overmuch stand helplessly before the spirit at bay. If this should be, I say, if this should be you of my heart, send me a little word that I may go unto him and take his hands, saying, accept all happiness from me. Then shall I turn my face and hear one bird sing terribly afar in the lost lands. A poem, It May Not Always Be So, by E.E. Cummings, from 100 Selected Poems, published by Grove Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Reputation.com, offering online review monitoring and management services for businesses that know the importance of online reviews. Learn more at Reputation.com. And by Nook, Simple Touch with Glow Light by Barnes & Noble, designed for bedtime reading. Glow Light offers paper-like reading with the lights on or off, available at neighborhood Barnes & Noble stores or Nook.com. Produced by Kathy Roach, written by Holly Vanderhaar. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Time is 3:44 and you are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau. Coming up next, a little bit of the Mudrooms presentation, this time by Pat McClear. First, a reminder that the State of Alaska, Bartlett Regional Hospital, and Pavitt Health and Fitness are presenting a public education event about obesity and its impact on the health of the country, previewing segments from the HBO documentary Weight of the Nation, followed by a discussion with Dr. Ward Hurlburt, Alaska's Chief Medical Officer, who will also provide an Alaska perspective on the issue. That event takes place tonight at 7 o'clock at the Egan Room at the Centennial Hall. If you have questions about that, you can call us at 586-1212.
It don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing. On Saturday, June 9th at JDHS, come see the Wayland Capital City Orchestra play the music of jazz legends Duke Ellington and George Gershwin at the Juno Symphony's 2012 Pops Concert. Over 50 local musicians will join the Thunder Mountain Big Band for a hot summer night of American jazz that will move and groove your righteous soul. Sunglasses optional. Tickets are on sale now. Short on cash? Check out their pay-as-you-can seats at junosymphony.org.
Next up, we have Pat McClear. Pat is a New Englander. She has been a librarian for the school district for the past 20 years. And she wrote, in parentheses, yikes. When asked for a bio to introduce herself, Pat gave us a couple of quotes. She writes, parent of elementary school student. My son was talking about you last night at the supper table. He said that Miss McClear was okay, but she doesn't take no crap from nobody. Pat thinks this might be a good quote for her headstone. Parent of a JDHS student. My son heard you say F asterisk 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 in the library. This, Pat wrote, is when she began to wonder if there was an opening at the public library. Then the JDHS parent continued, I'm so glad that someone human works here. Wrote Pat, quote, great sigh of relief. Maybe there is a God. A quote from Pat to a friend who was a parent of a kindergarten. Your son said F you, asterisk, asterisk, in the library today. So that was what Pat said to the parent. And then the parent said to Pat, oh, did he learn that from you? Okay, this is Pat's niece, who was a student at the school where Pat was a librarian, once gave her a, quote, cuss jar with a gift tag addressed to the, quote, cussing librarian. Pat says she will try to not cuss in her story. She also wrote that she collects nun dolls. Pat McClear.
The crowd, buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jack. I don't care if I ever get back. So it is the end of November. I'm sorry, the end of October. World Series is over, and it's time to take off the canvas cap and go with the wool, because the monsoon season has descended on Southeast Alaska. And the days are getting increasingly more dark. October rolls into November. November rolls into December. The rain goes to snain, goes to snow, and the taku winds begin to blow. And then it's time to go with flaps down. And aren't I glad there's no mirror by the door that I go in and out of every day. December's not bad. You got the winter holidays, food, family fun, eggnog. But it's January when the walls start to close in on you and you're trying to think how you're going to use up your time. Well, certainly you could play cards. You could sew. You might do a little reading. Or you watch movies. Okay. Angels in the Outfield, but only the original. The Rookie, Field of Dreams, Bull Durham, if only to watch Susan Sarandon. And then it's February, and you get to put in Fever Pitch, Boston Red Sox, 2004 World Series champions. Then it's truck day. What? Truck day? You know when that big-ass 18-wheeler goes down Yawkey Way, parks outside of Fenway, they load it up with the gear, then head down I-95 south to Florida. 2 weeks later, pitchers and catchers report. And now, you can go back to the wool because it's spring training. And all that wheeling and dealing that happened over the hot stove in December, well, there it is. You got the rookies, you got the veterans, you got a new manager.
And now I can pick up the canvas calf again because it's opening day and the umpire yells, play ball! I come by this naturally. I come by this genetically. 100 years ago, Fenway Park opened. 100 years ago, my father, Charlie McClear, was born. I have some great pictures. He was a tall, lanky, bony-ass kid who knew how to throw a baseball. Pawtucket Times, 1926. McClear had control with either hand and could hit a bird on the back of the ear with a pebble. Charlie told the story that he was playing one day, and he saw my mother sitting in the stands, and he knew that she was the girl he was going to marry. And his prophecy came true. They were married for damn near 60 years, had 6 kids, 18 years between the firstborn and the baby. And they shared a passion, not only for baseball, but for sports. My parents were athletically multilingual. My father played baseball, basketball, hockey, football, and my mother was knowledgeable and opinionated in all of the above and more. Story goes that one day they were going up the ramp in Fenway and Babe Ruth was coming down. Did you talk to him? Did you shake his hand? Did you get his autograph? You tip your cap, you give the man his space. 6 kids, grandchildren, the only picture in my father's wallet, Babe Ruth. Truth. Summer's in New England. It is hot, it is hazy, it is humid. And the only thing that man wanted to do when he came home at night was sit underneath that broad leaf maple with a tall neck bottle of Narragansett beer, listening to Ned Martin call that game live from Fenway Park. Who's up to bat? Who's on deck? The play just went 6-4-3. Yastrzemski makes a great catch out in left field. And in the evenings, the windows are wide open. And you can hear Ned Martin's voice coming over the radio from every room in the house. There's no air conditioning. His voice is your lullaby as you fall asleep. And in your mind's eye, you can see the green monster and that red Sitco sign. And you can imagine that ball sailing right between the two. And in the mornings, you wake up and you say, did we win? When my father was in his 80s, he was sitting underneath that same maple tree. And he was in a funk. And who's to blame him? He had buried my mother the winter before. And 7 years before that, he and my mother buried my sister Paula of, wait for it, Lou Gehrig's disease. Truth. Charlie wasn't into conversation. So I went into the house and I got this book. And I came back out, I sat beside him, and I opened it up and I started talking to myself. I didn't know Dizzy Dean had a brother. Brother? Yeah, he had 2. His brother Paul played with him in St. Louis. They both pitched in the World Series. Okay, I got an answer. So I kept asking questions, and he would elaborate, and he told me stories. He told me stories of the old-timers, the famous and the not-so-famous, the boys he played ball with. My father was a good ball player, but Charlie was an even better storyteller. And that's what gets you through those long, dark, wet, cold winters when it's necessary to go with the flaps down. It's the stories. It's the memories. It's the anticipation of opening day. Go Sox! For it's 1, 2, 3 strikes. You're out! At the old ball game.
3:57, and you are tuned to KTUO News In. And you know, here on a June afternoon, we heard from Pat McClear reading from the Mud Room's show on during March. You are tuned to KTUO. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. KTUO also broadcasts on these translators in the Valley and Ock Bay area. Tuned to K276 AF at 103.1, 11 in Schweitzer Creek, K269 AO at 101.7. Stavis listens on K201 AM 88.1. K220BT Sarasuna at 91.9. An excursion inland in Icy Strait, you can hear KTUO on K210AS 89.9. Also live online at www.ktuo.org. Thanks to Mark Wheeler and Amanda Compton for providing the Mudrooms presentations. Tomorrow at 3 on a June afternoon, Pat Moore will be your host. You can meet the Stevens Puppeteers performing tomorrow night at 6 o'clock in the Valley Library. Also talking to you, Yukus Principal. Sam Marino at the school. Ed Redder's Almanac, Birdo, and Music and More tomorrow at 3 on a Juneau afternoon. Weather forecast for tonight, partly cloudy skies with low temperatures around 46 degrees. Forecast for Tuesday, mostly cloudy skies with a chance of showers in the afternoon, high temperatures around 61 degrees. Tuesday night, rain showers likely with low temperatures around 46 degrees. Wednesday, cloudy skies with a chance of rain and high temperatures around 56 degrees. Anyway, next is All Things Considered. Thank you for tuning in to Juneau afternoon today, and have a great evening.
Time in the last at least two or three decades when it's been as good to buy as right now.
How central is home ownership to the American dream? For Monday, June 4th, this is All Things Considered from a